Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Many recognize in time.
Elvis Costello has made his own way in music for a long time. As a kid in the 70s with a signature sound that wasn't exactly punk, that played with rock, new wave, that was all his own. Since then, the Elvis Costello palette has just grown wider. His new album, National Ransom, goes after Wall Street Shakedown and a lot more. This hour on Point, Elvis Costello, you can join the conversation. What's your question, your word for Elvis Costello? Is the singer in the pork pie hat your man? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Since his 1977 debut, My Aim Is True, Elvis Costello has released more than 30 albums. His biggest American hits were Every Day I Write the Book and Veronica. He's famously collaborated with many of the biggest names in music, Paul McCartney to Roy Orbison to Lucinda Williams, his own wife Diana Krall, and many more. His new album is National Ransom. You can hear a bit at our website, onpointradio.org. From New York City, Elvis Costello, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm the man in the meat pie hat.
Yes. Well, I guess you are, or have become so. Tell us about your new album. What are you up to?
It's a record of rock and roll songs and ballads, and I've been joined by my longtime pals, the Imposters, and my new friends, the Sugarcanes, and we mixed them all up in a big bucket with a stick, and this is what came out.
The Sugarcanes is quite the group. Introduce us, if you'd be good enough. You have Leon Russell and more in there.
Well, Leon Russell came in to lead the band on one tune, but actually the Sugarcanes are a group of string band players, probably best known for playing bluegrass, which is why you sometimes see that the word bluegrass attached to both this record and the previous one I made, Secret Profane and Sugarcane, both made in Nashville, produced by T-Bone Burnett. Mm-hmm. I'd known a couple of the players in the band, Jerry Douglas and Jim Lauderdale, for about 20, 25 years, but I'd never got together to play any music with them until a couple of years back. And over the last 2 years, we've not only made, two recordings, but we've also been on the road, and the potential of that band with a double bass and a mandolin really being the rhythm section rather than a drummer gave me a whole new outlook, both on some of my older songs and pushed me forward writing some new songs. And by the end of our touring of 09, I had called T-Bone Burnett and said, you know, we need to book the studio again. I've got an idea for a different kind of record, a bigger scale of dynamic range. And by the time we actually got to the studio dates, I'd written a bunch of songs that had contained within them the sounds of the piano and a louder electric guitar, the mm-hmm. kind that my pal Mark Rebo plays. Mm-hmm. And hence, I ended up making a double LP, which is what National Ransom... Well, for my money, it sounds best on the double LP version. You can get it anywhere you want, you know, because these days you have to make it available.
Right. Double LP sounds so old-fashioned in more ways.
Well,
than
new
one.
New fashioned in my world, because it's right. A brand new surprise when you get that.
Absolutely.
Beautiful package. The cover
old is new again, right here. Yeah, even the was it what's the guy Millionaire who
Tony Millionaire illustration
did your cover art.
Yeah, he is an ink illustrator. He does a great comic strip, the Mackies. He has a very dark sense of humor. And I played him the music, and this is what he drew. He drew a wolf in banker's clothes running across the desert with a big bag of burning money. Well, it's not hard to find references to that in the news headlines, unfortunately. And some of the songs, the first song, National Ransom, mm-hmm. refer to the black comedy that we're all living through. And what we must do to persevere. And some of the stories, some of the narratives, and some of the characters in the songs on the album are about people who are finding their way through other trying times and hopefully finding that little bit of humanity, a little bit of solace. The record concludes with a song called A Voice in the Dark, which is a dedication to some kind of hope that comes from the voice of a lover or that one thought that keeps you prevailing despite all discouragement.
We're all for that, but it starts out a little rougher. Elvis Costello is with us. His new album is National Ransom. Let's listen to a little of the title track, and you'll hear it in here. Cutthroat, shakedown, you know, hocus pocus, killing on Wall Street, harem scarum running wild. Here's Elvis Costello's title track, National Ransom. Running wild just like some childish tantrum. Meanwhile, we're working every day, paying off the national ransom, title track from Elvis Costello's new record. Elvis, are you angry about economics?
Well, Merle Haggard wrote a great song called Working Man Blues about 35, 40 years ago. It said, I drink a little beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these Working Man Blues. And this song is just my update of that idea, because we've all of us, whatever means we have, we've sort of conspired with this catastrophe in some ways, handing the power to these alchemists in the world of the economics. It's my view that if you had proposed a negative value as something that you could trade as currency in the Middle Ages, they would have burned you as a witch. And probably would have been right to do that. So I think that, you know, it's very easy to point the finger because there's undoubtedly wrongdoing and probably some proper explanation rather than just piling more money into the big pit would be the way to go. I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. At the same time, it's because all of us, and I include myself in, we want a little bit more than we can afford, and we're you know, the chain of transactions that are in everyday life, we probably all need to take responsibility, and that's really what a lot of people are asking for. And then in other parts of the world, they don't have the luxury of even saying, well, I've got a choice between this way of life and that way of life. It's just survival, you know, so we're already doing so much better. So you can't be too catastrophic in it, but of course if it's happening to you and your family, it feels that way. There's no doubt about it, you know.
Can we talk about time travel, I guess, and you? I mean, from the very beginning, you had those Buddy Holly glasses, and everybody kind of enjoyed the reference. You had a lot of fun with it, made it part of your stage image. Now, in the years since...
I need them to see.
There is seeing.
The seeing part is the important
thing. But then there's
the
meat pie hat and the haberdashery and the sounds, where you very deliberately, both in the sound and in the kind of plots that run through some of these songs, and not for the first time on this album, you're traveling all through time. What's up with that? What do you take from that? What do you get from it?
Well, I think one thing is that if you are fixed just in the moment and looking for the brand new fashionable idea, it's going to go out of fashion very quickly. And some things that you find yourself thinking about when, if you're a songwriter, you stumble on stories. They're not always about, they are concerned with, or they surround an idea, and something pops out. In the case of some of the songs, a narrative, and in a few of the cases, I found myself locating them in a certain time and place, maybe finding some references in the language that put them there, references to conditions and actual physical places that I know of. Some of them have significance. My grandfather was a traveling musician, so was my father. So I know a little bit about that life. And it helped sort of place them in somewhere where I could make references to music that I like, and make it new again. I mean, I'm not yearning for the past. I'm not nostalgic by inclination, but I like a lot of different kinds of music and different styles and form, different pieces of art, musical architecture can be pressed into service to tell a tale, you know, and that's what I've done. Sometimes it's rock and roll, sometimes it's kind of another kind of rock and roll, which is more like ragtime or something.
Has that grown stronger as you've grown older? I mean, I look at Bob Dylan, he's doing not the same thing, but he also is looking back very clearly here. Is there something about when you get more decades under your belt, you want to roam over a wider time swath?
I don't know that it's maybe that I just have always listened to all this music because I grew up in a household full of great tunes and knew it from childhood. I wasn't stuck just with having to like, you know, I knew there was some other music and I didn't always have the patience for it. The mysteries of it weren't immediately revealed. I can't pretend that I understood all of these things, but they were available to me and the knowledge of them existing was there from childhood, from infancy, really. And some people are fearful of these other forms, and they feel like they're losing their religion in some way, or changing their allegiance if they listen to another kind of music, that particularly if it belongs to another social class. You know, I don't feel that way.
Hold the thought. Elvis Costello is with us. His new album is National Ransom. We'll do a little time travel right here, back to his My Aim Is True album, 1977, and Allison. You can join the conversation this hour if you followed Elvis Costello from way back, from Allison Radio, Radio Every Day I Write the Book. What's this musician, this artist, stand for to you? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I know this world is killing you, oh, Allison.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Elvis Costello about his life, work, and his new album, National Ransom. I lost you behind us right there from the album. Elvis Costello joins us from New York, and you can join the conversation as well. What's the Elvis Costello song, moment, insight that sticks with you? What's your question for Elvis Costello? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. He's going to play and sing a little bit for us in a minute. But Elvis, if we may, they are rushing the doors to talk to you. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Jack. Jack, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Elvis. How are you today?
I'm very good, thanks.
Good, good. Listen, it was amazing to just have the radio on and hear that you were on, because a group of us were discussing you last week, and I don't know how to form this into a question, but there was a group sitting around talking music, and we decided to write down our five favorite artists of all time. And Elvis, you were in my top five. I can't remember exactly. I think it was one. And the others at the table were amazed by that. And so we got into a conversation about you and sort of for lack of a better term, the tipping point in the United States for you when it all, I know that people of my generation, late 70s, early 80s, and in my area, which was New York, where I lived and went to college, you were it. I guess the question is, did you sense that this was happening and that there was a generation? I don't know if it was only young men or what you felt about your audience at that moment when it started to get big. And the album I would reference is this year's model that we just wore out, for lack of a better term.
Did you know?
Well, that's pretty great. I mean, of course, as a young man, I think you're probably just looking ahead, trying to do what you're doing. And I knew there were people at the shows, but I didn't know what they were identifying with. Sometimes I had the feeling maybe there was something good about it because it was fervent, and other times it felt a little unhealthy. Because it was like maybe they're taking something out of the songs that I didn't put in. But that's always, you have no way of knowing what people are hearing when you sing a song. After all, I've come from overseas. I listened to American rock and roll music and made, and I'm still listening to music, so lots of different types of music from New Orleans and from Nashville, and making something of my own out of, you know, my love of that music, write my own songs. So I don't know. I didn't know who those people were. I'd meet some of them, you know, after the show, and probably run around in the small hours of the night and meet all sorts of people and get into mischief and adventures. But I can't say I was. I tried not to be self-conscious about it. That it was. I was a representative or anything like that. I didn't feel that way. I just felt like I was me.
But it worked in a giant way. Can you tell us the story, you know, once more with feeling about Irish family, born in Liverpool? How did you go from being Declan Patrick McManus to being Elvis Costello?
Well, did you hear the very deliberate way that you had to pronounce that name?
Yes, I did.
I think that explains why I didn't go into show business with that name. My father, Ross McManus, you know, that's a little easier with the S's in there. But
right.
Declan before all those M's and N's,
yeah.
Not very easy if you're calling a club to get a booking, I can assure you. You know, and they expect a guy in a cable-knit sweater singing wailing songs at any rate, you know. And, of course, I was trying to write my own tunes. First of all, I was a folk singer. Then I was, not folk singer, but, I sang my own ballads and everything. And then I wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and it just didn't work. I took my paternal great-grandmother's name, Costello, as they say it in Ireland.
Okay.
So it is a family name. So it's not... I didn't completely
not out of nowhere.
Sort of abandon the family at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
Elvis,
you know,
that's
was actually I was actually born in London. My family is from Merseyside.
Oh, excuse me.
I feel sort of attached to that part of the world because all my family's from there. But now I feel, you know, at ease here in New York and in Vancouver, where my wife is from Vancouver Island.
Mm-hmm.
Our 4-year-old twin boys were born here in New York. So we have a sense of belonging wherever we are as a family. Most of the time we're traveling, you know, and that's how I probably have a different outlook on America and other parts of the world because we do so much traveling. And it's a very fortunate thing. I'm very grateful for that.
Elvis Costello is with us, and Mustang is finally determined to talk to you. Mustang, you're on the air.
Hey, Mustang. How you doing?
Elvis, what's up, man?
What's your question,
good,
Mustang?
Okay, I noticed early on in your career, one of your albums showed you pictured very reminiscent of Buddy Holly, and I was wondering what influences, if any, he had on your career. But I was wondering, have you ever done or considered doing a song in the old tongue?
In where?
In the what?
In the old tongue.
The old tongue, oh, Gaelic.
Oh, the old tongue. Well, no, not having grown up in Ireland, at least not in... I mean, I lived in Dublin for a few years, but long after I left school, I never learned Irish. I don't speak any Irish at all. I don't even really speak English very well, but let alone any other languages. Gibberish is my favorite language. I haven't. The Buddy Holly thing... I think I probably absorbed Buddy Holly unknowingly, like a lot of people of my age, through the Beatles. I mean, the music that they obviously were really loved, Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, the Everly Brothers, of course, because of the harmony and Buddy Holly. That music was all just slightly past. You know, I was aware of it. But when I first noticed rock and roll, growing up in a house that really was focused on jazz and ballad singers, that's what my dad was doing, I didn't really hear rock and roll when it first came out. I'm actually too young to have heard it firsthand. I heard it kind of on the second time round when the beat groups, as we call it, the Beatles obviously being the most famous, started to kind of rework it. And a lot of the time, being a kid, if you like a group, you think they made up all those songs. I didn't. It took a moment or two for me to find out that the Beatles didn't write Roll Over Beethoven, didn't write You Really Got a Hold on Me. And of course, that begins the process of being curious about who is this Smokey Robinson? You know, who is the guy behind these... Who are the guys behind these Tamla, as we called it, Motown records? Mm-hmm. Who's the guy writing these Lee Dorsey records that were on the radio? Of course, it turns out to be Alan Toussaint. I could never have imagined that any of these people would end up being people I'd collaborate with. When I was a kid, it was just music playing on the radio that I liked. The same as I'm sure you feel about Buddy Holly. You know, he wrote terrific songs, and it's one of those great curiosities as to imagining all the places he might have gone had he not died so young, you know.
Elvis Costello, we'd love to hear a little bit more from your new album, National Ransom, and I am led to believe you may be prepared to perform something. What have you got for us?
Well, I'm going to... A little early in the morning for singing, but I'm going to sing a song about a cowboy singer. There's an Englishman traveling around on the music hall theatre circuit in 1937, and he's carrying a battered suitcase containing a book of poems by John Keats and a lariat that he uses in his act.
It's called Jimmy Standing in the Rain.
And he's wearing a suit of stolen clothes, and he's chosen just the wrong moment to go into cowboy music. If there was ever a right moment to go into cowboy music.
Great.
Third class ticket in his pocket, punching down the shadows underneath the socket, tweed coat turned up against the fog. Slow coaches rolling all the mall between the very memory and approaches of all. Stale bread curling on a luncheon gown, loose change, lonely, not the right amount. Forgotten man, indifferent nation, waiting on a platform at a Lancashire station. Somebody's calling you again. It's finally dawn and Jim is standing in the rain. Nobody wants to buy a counterfeited pair of lullaby in a colliery town. The hip flask and fumble skein of some stage door Josephine is all you get now. Eyes going in and out of focus, mild and bitter from tuberculosis. Forgotten man, indifferent nation, waiting on a platform at a Lancashire station. Somebody's calling you again. It's finally dawn and Jim is standing in the rain. Her soft breath was gentle on his neck. If he could choose the time to die, then he would come and go like this, underneath the painted sky. She woke up and called him Charlie by mistake, and then in shame began to cry. Tarnished silver band peels off her friends and then warms their hands around the brazier. Forgotten man, indifferent nation, waiting on a platform at a Lancashire station. Somebody's calling you again. The sky is falling, Jim is standing in the rain. Brilliantine glistening, your soft plaintive whistling, and your one wandering smile. Died down in the hippodrome, now you're walking off to jeers. The lonely sound of jingling spurs, the toodaloos and all my dears. Down at the Argyle, vile vaudevillians applaud sobriety. There's no place for a half-cut cowboy in polite society. Forgotten man, indifferent nation, waiting on a platform at a Lancashire station. Somebody's calling you again. It's finally dawn and Jim is standing in the rain. Somebody's calling you again. It's finally dawn and Jim is standing in the rain. Jim is standing in the rain.
Elvis Costello in NPR studios in New York, and what a great job setting you up there. That's just terrific. Thank you so much, Elvis, at this
Thank
hour.
You.
That's terrific. Just wonderful, wonderful. Hey, you've had such a, you know, a career that's been in so many directions. Has that ever been you, the guy, you know, Forgotten Man in Different Nations, Standing in the Rain. Have you had that moment?
Oh, I don't think so. Not in the way that guy has described. I've had attention, indecent amount of attention and praise and blame on most things I've done. I don't think that's right. If you have this ambition to rule the world through music, you're inevitably going to be disappointed when people come up to me and say, my kid is wants to get into music, and do you have any advice? As if there's a magic trick to it. I go, well, you have to decide whether you're in it for the music vocationally, or as is the temptation in some of the nightly entertainments on television that begin with the stage directions, flood the arena and then release the crocodiles. Yeah, you know that it's a route to fame. You know, and right. That releasing the crocodiles thing never really ended very well. Look at what happened to the Romans. You know, so
the Rolling Stones did all right. On the other hand.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually they didn't. When it got to the release the crocodiles moment, yeah, you know, when you really unloose those things, it actually ends badly.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that everything should be genial. I mean, of course, there's more than a place for mayhem in music, mm-hmm. and much great music has come from it. But I think in terms of feeling like it's an easy route to just fame or even infamy through music, that's destined to disappointment, as is trying to accumulate a larger and larger audience by the repetition of a brand. I mean, I think in the end it becomes either a very closed up club, or it becomes this hideous ritual that lacks any of the qualities that inspired you to get into it in the first place. And you have to take the degree of risk of some people leaving the room when you do something that you love. If you do it out of love and curiosity, then you've got to be prepared for the fact that not everybody's going to go with you, and some people like the songs you began with, but at the same time, every new thing I've done, there's been some people that have walked in the room at that moment, and you've got to remember that. That's what you focus on. You play for the people who are listening, not the people who aren't listening.
They go and they come. Lots of callers. Elvis, Charleston, South Carolina. Elizabeth, you're on the air with Elvis Costello.
Oh my God, I'm a huge fan and have been since the beginning, and just applaud your fearlessness and the ability to just change it up and always seem to surprise and delight and inspire that. I'm an artist, and there's nothing more thrilling than changing direction. And I have a 17-year-old, and she's not into music, but I do have to tell you, you were the first concert I ever took her to at 12 in Charlotte, and she's a big fan.
Well, that's pretty great. I really appreciate that, you know. I mean, I don't really think...
I can't say she was really happy about it. She was a little...
No, I'm sure you probably had to cover her ears, I would hope, and at some of the more indecent things I sang. But
well, I do... I promise you, yesterday I overheard her iPod, and blaring rather loudly was another episode of Blonde, so it's great.
Wow. And that's a good... That's not exactly a common choice, so I appreciate that. I mean, in terms of changing... style, I like I just said a moment ago, I don't even feel that is anything. I'm always a little bit wary of protestations of courage in art. I mean, I think it's boldness or panaches are the correct words. The more joyful words, really. I think bravery is an innocent man facing a firing squad. You know, that's bravery. Or doing something really unprecedented that really benefits everybody. I think in music anyway, we do stand to gain when we go up there, and if we get tomatoes thrown at us, then sometimes that's right, I guess, if we're making the wrong choices or have carried ourselves up there unprepared. I try not to do that, certainly not these days, and I think, you know, I appreciate you saying it, but nevertheless, I don't really feel worthy of the compliment. It's just what I do instinctively.
Elizabeth, thanks very much for your call from South Carolina there. We're going to hear a lot more music from National Ransom, Elvis Costello's brand new album. He joins us today from the NPR studios in New York, and thanks to them, that was a terrific live performance, Elvis. We really enjoyed that. We'll come back
for
more music and more from Elvis Costello. Here's Less Than Zero from My Aim Is True, again, 1977. You can join us with all Elvis Costello's changes. What stays the same for you? How do you stay at it 30, 40 years and keep it vital, keep them coming? How does Elvis Costello do it? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I don't want protected, so your body won't go.
Mistreat me, darling, and I might just disappear. Upon a freight of running dark out of Algiers. But tiny grin.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Elvis Costello about his life and work and his new album, National Ransom. Here's All These Strangers from the new album. Elvis Costello joins us from the NPR studios in New York City, and you're welcome to join us as well, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Big profile of you this week in the New Yorker magazine, page after page on Elvis Costello, and I've got to ask you about a couple things you've been asked about before, but people will be wondering. The time infamous, famous, you call it both ways, maybe back in Columbus, Ohio, when you sort of, I guess you were letting your hair down, had a few brews after a performance, went after Ray Charles and went after James Brown and Bonnie Bramlett, no less, of Delaney and Bonnie, I don't know, decked you, took you to the ground, had a brawl. What was going on there, Elvis?
You know what? I've talked about this a lot over the years, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to open that up for people to half hear it. And I think it's been very well explained. When you're youthful, you have a sense of self-righteousness, mm-hmm. which obviously, I mean, I spent last Sunday week watching the Buffalo Springfield play at the Bridge School Benefit. That band contained Stephen Stills. It was his band that were, you know, Stephen and I are cool. You know, it's been great. It was great to share the stage for a great objective like that. Mm-hmm. And when I saw him earlier this year, we hadn't seen each other since that night. And his attitude was to it, and was, goodness, you know, we were all out of our minds in those days. Saying something to win a bar argument and then having it reported and batted around mm-hmm. as a little tidbit, mm-hmm. running the risk of actually offending people again, when really it was the complete opposite of my beliefs. In my youthful, you know, self-righteousness, mm-hmm. I believed that the people I was confronting were somehow riding on the backs of this music that I loved, and, you know, sort of used this reverse humor, which is common in England, to try and make a point, right. which was obviously lost on them in the drunkenness that everybody was
probably
experiencing.
In that night in Columbus, yeah, I guess.
So, you know, I think it's something that people bring up. It's also a burdensome thing to think that any room you walk in, people might have half the idea of this and believe that somehow, you know, I have a white hood under the bed that I wear after dark, you know.
Yeah.
I think you have to judge me by my work and my actions, and not by some hearsay.
We're ready to do it.
Something.
T-Bone Burnett says you're almost American now. I mean, way back then you certainly were not. But what about
Americana? I don't think I'm American. I am. I think that writers, you know, an awful lot of crime writers imagine all sorts of dastardly things, but I don't know too many of them that are actually murderers. you know, they imagine that, and they're writers and authors. Time travel, as you said before, they go on location. Mm-hmm. Actors take on roles, some of them really, really wicked people. They go into outer space, you know, they come back unscathed. And songwriters, of course, can do that. I don't set myself up as a poet or anything like that, because the discipline of poetry is something that I've never really subscribed to. I'm a lyricist because it's, and I have a peculiar sort of, my own peculiar idea of it that's unique to my way of thinking mm-hmm. and my curiosities. And in conjunction with music, you can travel, you can go on location, you can have the music pull in a different direction to the lyric, you can offer more than one perspective, almost in a kind of way a cubist painting does. I mean, you've got all these possibilities. That's why songwriting is such a wonderful thing to do. And I honestly believe, I don't say this in a fanciful, idealistic way, I honestly believe most people probably have a song within them or a great story within them, and we sort of get discouraged out of drawing and playing after we leave school and the environments where those things are hopefully encouraged, perhaps less so than they used to be. And if you read a little bit of history, you know there were times when arts were kept more in balance with I suppose, the sciences which serve industry. Mm. And you don't want a bunch of people who just know about IT and they don't know anything about art or they don't know how to let loose things within them that would be beautiful, you know.
But T-Bone's pointing.
Beauty and mayhem and have an equal part in this. Mm-hmm. And national identity hasn't really very little to do with it. I just happen to have grown up receiving images of America that were mysterious through music, through movies, probably my parents' generation had a different view that through jazz and a Hollywood, great era Hollywood movies. Each generation has a different language to respond to, and there are musics from all over the world, but probably our failure to learn other languages is it closes off a lot of the meaning, but the feeling comes through in music. That's why people listen to music from all over the place, from every time and place as well. Mm.
Certainly a lot of Americana on this album, National Ransom and The Last, but you've also got settings practically in the liner notes for these, and there's one, You Hung the Moon, sort of set in the liner notes, a drawing room in Pimlico, London, 1919. Let's listen to a little bit of Elvis Costello's You Hung the Moon from National Ransom.
You hung the moon from a gallows in the sky, choked out the light in his blue lunar eye. The shore is a parchment, the sea has no tide. Since he was taken from my side, the lines of the fallen are viewed through the glass. You cannot touch them at all or hear their footfall just as they go past.
You Hung the Moon from National Ransom. Let's go to Leslie in Atlanta, Georgia. Leslie, you're on the air with Elvis Costello.
Hurrah. Hi, Elvis.
Hey there, Leslie. How are you doing?
I'm beyond the moon right now.
Come back.
I wanted to tell you that my daughter also went to her first concert in my 1980s Elvis Costello t-shirt at Chastain in Atlanta, when you were here with Alan Toussaint, and it was a great experience.
Thank you for that.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Well, that's a gentleman that I've been very fortunate to share the stage with, and I'm glad that she saw him as well, because he's remarkable. You know,
the whole evening was magical. It was just great. So thank you so much for that. I wanted to ask you if you plan on doing an album with your wife. And then also to let you know, this phone call has completed my life. I can die happy now.
Wow.
Well, don't do that. Don't do that. Diana and I, we tend to perform just occasionally together. And I did help when she wanted to write some songs a few years ago. There were some things that she needed to say in her own words rather than through the interpreting other people's songs for which she's best known. It was a difficult time to transition. She lost her mother, and she said herself that singing the songs that she had loved so much didn't really express the way she felt. And you know, as we've been talking about, and some of the questions have been, there's a time for singers, artists, or whatever we want to call ourselves, to do some other things, to be honest, really, to be honest about your feelings and put that before the audience. And of course, that runs the risk of some people being horrified. But I saw her play a year ago at the Albert Hall, and she played at the most swinging set with her great band, with terrific musicians Anthony Wilson, Kareem Riggins, and Bob Hurst. And they just set the place on fire, and she came out and sang one of the songs that I'd really only done editorial work on the lyric. And as the encore, she sang this song, Departure Bay. And it felt as if, getting just 2 or 3 years away from the initial release of the record, the song had found its place among all of these songs that she knows and loves. She knows songs from the 1920s and 30s, many of which we share a love of, and she knows and loves songs that were written in the last 30 years, which are not commonly thought to be part of the great American songbook, but of course are, if you really thinking about what that really means. It embraces everything, and it speaks out to the world. And if we had the opportunity to do something, it would maybe mean that we would spend more time together as a family. This summer, we managed to find a series of engagements in Europe at jazz festivals that had a very broad policy of music that they presented. So we actually appeared on the same bill, which was terrific. But we haven't planned it, but if it should happen, it has to be for the real feeling of the music. It can't be something that we do just because our names kind of will, you know, hope to double the fortunes of the record. I don't think that would ring true to people, and probably wouldn't be right for either of our audiences or the audience that would be there for the joint work. It must be truthful, you know.
We've got just a little bit up our sleeve of one example where you did sing together. This is you and Diana Krall, your wife, with Willie Nelson, his classic song Crazy, a live performance on Nelson's 2009 album Lost Highway. You'll hear Elvis Costello come in first, then Willie Nelson and Diana Krall.
I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying, crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. For crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
Just a lick of the misses there, Diane Krall, Willie Nelson, and Elvis Costello.
I'd forgotten about that. I'd forgotten about that. You know, there's a funny story about that. We were having supper with our manager, Steve Macklem, and we just asked him sort of what else are you doing in town while you're here in New York, because we're all based in Vancouver. And he said, Nora Jones is playing Willie Nelson's 70th birthday tomorrow night with a bunch of other people, and she was also managed by Steve. And we said, oh great, can we go to the gig and see it? And he rang up the producers and said, yeah, you can come if you sing Crazy. So we only ended up on the stage singing like one of Willie's best songs.
That's all.
At 24 hours notice, not even 24 hours notice, about 16 hours notice.
But that's great.
He is just the greatest, you know. I mean, when you think about that, he wrote that song. I mean, he wrote it. He not only sings. I mean, earlier in the song, he takes a verse. It's just amazing when he opens his mouth. I mean, it's terrific.
It sure is.
Amazing man.
Jason, Plymouth, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air with Elvis Costello.
Yes,
Plymouth,
thank you,
Massachusetts.
First Guillermo de Toro, and now Elvis Costello, my favorite musician. But I saw you in the Speaking Clock review in Boston last month.
Oh, did you? How did you? Did you like that?
I saw. Pardon?
Did you enjoy the evening?
Oh, it was fabulous. I was in the third row. One of the questions I have for you is: I've seen you many times in concert, Elvis, but your facial expressions are so entertaining. Have you ever thought about having roles in feature films, acting? And another question I have is: you introduced John Cougar and said he's writing some of the best songs of his career. Do you feel that's the direction you're going in? Because I think your songs are better and better. And finally, I know you were asked about Diane Krall a little bit earlier, but does her virtuosity intimidate you at all?
Good question.
That's a good question.
Player.
I mean,
I'll take my answer off the air. Love you, man.
Thanks, Jason.
Yeah, and all three questions are good. I mean, just to briefly explain, the Speaking Clock Tour was something that T-Bone Burnett put together. It was two concerts that we did on the East Coast in Boston and in New York, which were benefit concerts for the Waiting for Superman documentary about public
education. Yeah.
And it was a terrific bill. I mean, if you say the names, the Punch Brothers, the Secret Sisters, Karen Elson, John Mellencamp, Greg Allman, Dr. Ralph Stanley, Nico Case.
Incredible.
I mean, they were all playing, and Elton John and Leon Russell and myself. I acted as MC. Of course, everybody was accompanied by the same group, and it ran like a review with a couple of songs by one artist, then three by another, and then another artist would come back. Jeff Bridges did two songs. Mm. it was a spectacular evening, and I love the fact that perhaps the youngest artists, the Secret Sisters, are these girls in their early 20s from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and Dr. Ralph Stanley really stole the show, really, with the quietest music of the evening. And the atmosphere was a tremendous one. So I really appreciate that, because I don't know. In terms of my facial expressions, I have no idea what's going on there.
I have been
in a few movies. I can't call what I've done in them acting. I always wondered what would happen if I was actually given something that was really, you know, I had to learn lines and be a character, whereas I have appeared in a few where I'm usually a version of myself. Singer in meat pie hat walks into room, right. Speaks to pretty girl, leaves. That's usually the stage directions.
And intimidated by Diana Krall.
Diana is incredibly modest about her ability as a piano player. A lot of people know her as a vocalist from her recordings. When they go to the concerts, they hear the interaction with the terrific instrumentalists that she plays with, which she can more than hang with, and she has. Particularly the feel that she has is great, and I can't say that what I do when I sit at the piano could be called playing. It's a tool for me for composition, because it's diagrammatic, and there are certain types of song I write there. I can accompany myself in a rudimentary fashion on the piano, and really, truthfully, not much better on the guitar. I've sort of honed a few things on the guitar, but I've deliberately kept the instrumental things relatively primitive, because I can hear more complex music, but I also like the simple forms as well. And if you keep those in balance, then that seems to be right for me. For her, of course, there's so many more possibilities. And there's nothing better than hearing somebody lose themselves in the best way in music when they're playing. I mean, lose themselves in the sense they have lost themselves to the spirit of the music, and it's all the more thrilling when it's somebody you love.
Elvis Costello. The new album is National Ransom. It's been great talking with you this hour, Elvis. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Elvis Costello with guitar. Thanks for the live performance as well there at NPR Studios in New York City. We'll go out with one more track from National Ransom. This is A Slow Drag with Josephine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Walls, then comes the flirtation and temptation. Listen to what I say, then you can take it away.